What's up, y'all? It's Zach with Living Corporate. Look, every single day, I wake up and I'm passionate about centering and amplifying Black and Brown folks at work. Right? We go through these seasons where people act like we're so needed and precious, and then we go through these seasons where we're just treated disposably. Right? We've seen that really heightened since 2020, the murder of George Floyd, and we saw all these pledges and stuff. And we saw all this language and commitments from organizations. But now we're seeing a lot of folks renege on all those commitments and pledges, right? We're seeing Black and Brown folks continue to be disparately impacted by massive layoffs in the tech industry. The industry that was promoted as the place for Black and Brown folks to get some equitable treatment and to have some sort of financial security and wealth generation. We're seeing a continual backtracking from the same people that boldly said that Black lives matter. Okay. But the good news is, for me anyway, and for Living Corporate, is we existed before diversity, equity, and inclusion was hyper in vogue. And we're going to continue to exist as diversity becomes a disgusting cuss word. Right. The other good news I'm going to say is that we don't really subscribe to all of that hyper white liberal jargon. That is really what diversity, equity, and inclusion is. It's a bunch of different gobbledygook words that don't really mean much, that really aren't defined well. I'm excited about the fact that we have conversations with executives, activists, elected officials, entrepreneurs, influencers, artists, and every single week, dare I say every single day, we're publishing content that challenges systems, structures, and people to do right by historically marginalized people. And by historically marginalized, I mean Black and Brown queer, Black and Brown trans, Black and Brown disabled, Black and Brown men, Black and Brown women, Black and Brown non-binary, Black and Brown first generation, Black and Brown people, right? The country is going to continue to get blacker and browner. And it's important that our voices continue to be heard. I still believe that the strongest weapon and the biggest gift I have is my voice. And Living Corporate is a megaphone and an amplifier for all things Black and Brown at work. So I'm happy that you're listening. Welcome to the network. We outside, baby. Let's go. Now, look, the next thing you're going to hear, we're going to have, you know what I'm saying, our interview. I'm excited for you to check out this interview. Don't go nowhere. I'm going to see you in a minute. Peace. And welcome to the show. How you doing?
Doing great. Thank you for having me.
Listen, I'm excited because, we're talking about, as I think about this market, I think about like all the conversations, frankly, like contentiousness we've had around like in tech of like, what's tech, what's not, and who's in tech and who really isn't and all this stuff. And for me, it's like, I'm of the position that, like, first of all positions genuinely matter, right? And especially when you talk about historically marginalized groups, think about like anybody in STEM, if you're in the role, hey, if you're in tech, you're in tech. Like, let's not create artificial hierarchies in a space. It's weird. And like my feedback has also been like, so recently, I wouldn't say the person's name if I could remember, but I literally can't remember. But there was this whole conversation about some of y'all think y'all are in tech and y'all aren't, like the coders. We're the people who are really in tech, the people who really write script. And my position then and still now is coding is incredible. It's the technical skill to like bring something from theory into reality. Like being able to go on a keyboard and write a language so then I look on a screen and experience something is like magic, right? At the same time, it's not the only thing that's involved in creating products and services that go out into the market. And I think one of the more uncomfortable truths is that the people that really influence and drive tech are the folks that really touch and are closer to product strategy, go-to-market, product marketing. I'd love to talk a little bit more about, I'd love to hear more about your journey, how you got into the product space, and what's keeping you in this, like, in this dimension of tech.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of angles there. And I think one of the things you touched on is really, yes, tech is a label, and it is something where, you know, it's hard to get into. There's a lot of really specialized skills. So it is something to feel proud that you work in tech. It is something where if you can code, you know, it makes sense to feel proud that you can code, especially if you do that full time as a developer. I kind of know how to code. I studied engineering, not computer science specifically, but I had to learn C++. So that was, you know, a serious language. It's an OG language. But so, like, I have so much respect for developers and what they do and what they contribute. And at the end of the day, though, you know, there's like value. And what value are you providing to the customer in the form of a service or a product? And there are a lot of, you know, maybe not a lot, but there are some, you know, developers out there that are very product focused. And this is actually a conversation that's happening a lot in the product community right now about what really is going to be happening to the product role moving forward when, if you have somebody who is, whether they're UX, whether they're sales, whether they're a developer, and they have really sharp product skills and they can kind of fill in certain gaps with like Gen AI, right? Because there's a lot of things where it's like a lot of these things can be automated. So if you don't have a really sharp like product sense, like this one product leader Shreyas usually talks about, also people like Claire Vo, also in the product space, it's kind of like you as a product person, what are you doing to contribute to that value? But I think it becomes like a people who are like, well, you are this or you're not really that. The question also becomes like, well, the reason why your specific skill is valuable is because other people in the space can't really provide that specific type of value to the product. Like, I'm not a great like programmer, but it is something where somebody's saying, well, you know, I'm a great programmer, but maybe they don't have that product sense. And like, you know, that's not something that they are working to refine. It's something where it's like, well, what happens when, you know, other engineers become like these 50X engineers? Because how good the co-pilots get. I kind of know how to code a little bit, but I'm starting to play with some of the Gen AI prototyping tools, even some of the ones where they're just actually using AI to help you just be able to easily deploy like a prototype. And I'm kind of like partnering with like ChatGPT for the ones that are a little, require a little bit more code, because I don't need it to be like really good. It's not going to be like, hey, this is going to go to prod. But this is something where I'm like, hey, like, what happens when, you know, certain parts of the labor equation shift? And I think that's not a thing specifically for engineers. It's a question product managers need to ask. It's something designers need to ask themselves. Things in sales, there's all these things. I think especially people where their roles are, you know, like scrum master, project manager, with like, there's still strategy in there, but like a lot of companies really use those more for like, hey, let me just make sure these things are moving forward in terms of that's how the companies use those roles. Not saying that's all those roles should be.
And but the function.
Yeah. And so I think that's like really like, we all are really here because we are trying to add value for a very specific persona, very specific user or like customer. And that's really the core of it. And I'm like, you can be like, yeah, I'm in tech or I'm in healthcare, or I'm this, that. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Unless you are like being like, this is how I add unique value that is, I'll say, less interchangeable than other types of value. And so I know there's like a lot in there and probably didn't get to all parts of your question, but like what you were saying, you know, just I always like to center on, you know, having people take a step back and be like, well, okay, what is the value to that person who's going to be paying money, whether this is like a multi-million dollar recurring contract, or this is something where someone's just paying for their Spotify subscription, you know, what is the value that you are providing to the user to make sure that this is really providing value? Because there's a reason why Spotify overtook Pandora, because how they, it's not just that the thing exists, it's that somebody is providing value better to the customer than that other product. And obviously marketing and other things there, but over time, that value piece wins.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's the experience that you're that you're delivering. Like, it's gonna resonate with users, and can over time even beat out a bunch of marketing, right? Because ultimately, if you say, well, look, I mean, I just remember all the jokes even about just Spotify versus Apple on its playlisting on its music recommendations, right? So it's like there'd be the memes about how Spotify, oh, I looked at the last 1 million songs you listened to, and I looked at your ancestry and figured out this perfect recommendation. And this joke about like why are these Spotify recommendations always so great compared to Apple that are just kind of okay? I think something else that you said earlier though resonates with me too about like product sense. And correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like you're saying product sense is really more about, it's more intuitive and more of an art than a science. There's a science to it as well, but like the ability to be able to look at something in real and like ask the questions to make sure that like whatever this product is actually going to be, create the value and experience, the desired value and experience for customers. I think it's hard. It's going to be a challenging season, right? It was already a challenging season for thousands of people. I want to say latest numbers, like 7,000 folks have been laid off already this year across from Google and Discord and a bunch of other firms. And you see the CEO of Google talking about more layoffs and a real double and triple down on generative AI. I get concerned about like how much of, like what recipes, what sauce are we losing in leveraging AI in the ways that we are? But at the same time, it's kind of like, I think that if people could kind of say, look, if we could make if we can make like an A-plus burger, if we can make an A-plus burger and make like 50 of them a day for $5, or we could make a B-minus burger and make 5,000 of them for $2, well, we're going to probably choose that B-minus burger. And I think some of it is, I think that's what we're going to be seeing. I mean, when you see like with Duolingo, like we're seeing with their large language models, and we're seeing a bunch of folks getting laid off. The contractors being cut from those positions. When you say and you talk about thinking about ways that you can provide differentiated value for users, like what examples kind of come to mind for you that you're like, okay, this is a great example of something that can't really be usurped or undermined by a generative AI tool?
I don't think there's anything inherently safe from generative AI. I think generative AI becomes a collaborator. And I think that, you know, taking another step back, we're in the middle of the fourth industrial revolution. People have been talking about how this is going to impact jobs. Historically, we've seen this trend of, you know, jobs, job loss, new jobs get created. There's a lot of debate about it with AI. Yes, there will be new jobs created, but like, what is that ratio of loss to gain and what new industries will be created? And some of this is also going to depend on like regulation. Like, are there going to be, you know, people required to watch fleets of cars, automated vehicles? You know, is that a new role? And like, how many people do you need to do that? Probably not as many as you need Uber drivers. So like, what does that do? And I think it's a question of, you know, when you even see things like when we put things on the internet, you had a people under people who were like typists, right? They're just typing all day, like taking notes, that sort of thing. And it was kind of like, oh, well, now everyone could just kind of do it for themselves because if you could get everyone in the office computer, you don't need this like clunky typewriter, all this other stuff. But the reason why we have Microsoft, people put Microsoft Office on their resumes today is because once upon a time, not everyone actually knew how to use Microsoft Office. When I was in high school, we actually like took like typing classes that were on a computer. They showed us where to put everything, you know, where everything was in the office suite. You know, when I was engineering, I studied industrial and operations engineering. So, you know, there was a lot of statistics, a lot of data. So that also meant getting really phenomenal in Excel. My Excel skills probably are not as phenomenal as they were back then. But those were things where it's like, those were skills because not everyone could do them. You really actually had to understand that to really be able to be that person to be like, oh, I got the insight from the data. Oh, I can put office on my resume because not everybody has that skill. And I think that, you know, now it's like, hey, if you're putting office on your resume, you know, what century are you in? Right. Like, that's, I mean, you and I probably feel like a little offended when people are like, yeah, that from like the late, like 1900s, we're like, whoa, slow down. But like, that's the honest truth now. Right. Like, that's like putting that on your resume is like a late 1900s thing. Mm-hmm. And now AI is really figuring out how to use generative AI, because there's a lot of stuff that it's still a bit like working with an intern who doesn't really have context. They can do stuff, but they don't have context. There's still a lot of collaboration. Is mm-hmm. people who are going to get ahead are going to figure out, how do I use generative AI as my collaborator? And how do I use it in ways that you aren't going to just put Gen AI on your resume as is, but you're going to figure out, like one of the things that I want to get very good at is using generative AI for prototyping and using generative AI to run experiments for research. And that's something where that's a skill I have to build up. There aren't classes yet. I know of other product managers like Peter Yang. He's a brilliant product manager. He's over at Roblox. He talks about it a lot. Claire Vo, she just left Color. She also talks about this a lot. And I think there's certain skills depending on like what type of things you want to do, not even just your role, because roles and their names might change, but what do you want to, what type of impact you want to have on products? You have to figure out what I'm going to be using generative AI as my collaborator for, and why, and like, how am I adding value ultimately to a product with generative AI? And so I think this is a thing where to assume anyone is safe is, you know, a massive error. And another thing, I know this is kind of a long piece, but one thing I do want to touch on is, so I won't name it here, but both my parents, they're retired. They worked for like a very large, you know, corporation for like about 40 years of their career. It was like, they're in like the manufacturing business. And, you know, I remember when I was a kid, they had like all these perks. It wasn't just like, oh, you have coffee in the snack room and you have like a nice cafeteria. And the cafeteria, we still had to pay, but it was like cheaper. It wasn't like Google level. But it was like, even like, if I had a sick day and couldn't go to daycare, they would actually send a babysitter to like stay home with your kids so you could go to work. Because also you couldn't remote work, all this other stuff. And I remember, you know, as a kid being like, oh, okay. Yeah, no, that's normal. That's what my parents do. They go to work every day. That's kind of part of it. And every year hearing my parents say, oh, you know, there's talks about doing another round of layoffs. And this would go on like every other year, like more layoffs. And then it'd be like, oh, you know, we're finally to the point where like, hey, they stopped providing coffee in the break rooms. And oh, you know, on this campus, they actually shut down the cafeteria in that one. Oh, they shut down all the cafeterias except for the one in the main building. Everyone has to go there if you want a cafeteria to be able to use. And then it was just like, you know, that was, you know, when I was a kid, and now it's like nearly like 40 something years later. And I'm like, they're still doing layoffs. Like, my mom actually retired like maybe like a year or two earlier than she was going to, because they were offering packages to people who wanted to retire early, because they were like, hey, we're about to do layoffs. Anyone want to just volunteer to retire early? Mm-hmm. And I've thought about this actually for like over like a decade. And it's part of the reason why being in emerging tech has been so important to me, is seeing people who are really like not that old, like in their 40s and 50s, like finally get laid off. And hearing my parents talk about the struggle that these people, where it's like there were other jobs in that market with similar things, you know, struggled to find new jobs. Many of them did, but it was still hard, especially like ageism, other reasons, all this other stuff, just like the changing landscape of like industries are done in America versus like exporting them overseas. And I think of Gen AIs, we're not exporting it overseas, we're exporting the labor into like an automated machine. And I think about that, and that I really think this age of kind of constant expansion, right, in tech, because it was such a green field, you know, you have Facebook where we've actually kind of, unless they can actually figure out a reliable way to get Wi-Fi to like very remote places, they actually don't have a way to get new users, right? And this has been a problem for like the last decade for them. That's why they've tested, you know, internet drones, a bunch of other things, because they're like, we don't have ways to get new users. Same, similar issues with like Google. They just can create new products, hope they get adoption for it. And in the tech industry right now, I think it is going to be like, you are going to evolve very hard place. But it is like, this is like a call to arms to be like, you really have to like lean in, like really. Because yes, right now it's like AI. Blockchain is on the bleeding edge. It's not quite in a place where it really, where like if the internet wasn't fast enough, your Visa transaction, you'd be like, this is taking forever. Here's a check, right? We have to get add value. But the reality is that like, what happens? Because I still need to be working in 10 years. I hope I don't. Early. Right now, it looks like I'm still going to be working in 10 years. And so my thought is, you know, what about after that? Where does this evolve us? Where does this take us? Especially for, you know, professionals of color, you know, tech in general. Yes, come in with the skill that is needed now, but always be working. You are still in demand. So as the market continues to evolve, you're not one of these people that's like, how do you already have like 5 years of experience in that? Like, I've literally just heard about it yesterday. Like, we can't be in that position. And there's so many layers to it, from like education, training programs, other things. Like, you see people like Amazon, they funded like an AI Now program that I think trained like 2 million people in AI. Right. But like, we need to be like in our own communities thinking like futurists, because right now it's AI, like blockchain. I think when it gets to its point, it's gonna be even more on fire. But really, it's beyond that, and looking at like, what are the edge cases? What are the edge signals so that we can be prepared? Because tech is, it's still gonna be there, but it's gonna be very, very different with AI.
Yeah, and I think like something you said at the top of it is like leveraging AI tools as a partner, like leveraging it as a resource, as a tool. And like it's both ways, right? So employees, individuals need to figure out and leverage AI as a tool and a resource to help accelerate and or expand what they're doing. I think also organizations have an opportunity to think about AI as a tool to help enrich employee experience as opposed to undermine or replace employees, right? So you think about like, hey, so obvious example, you think about generative AI these days, it's just marketing and content development. I want to say there was a major sports publication that got exposed for like basically manufacturing a bunch of articles.
Yeah.
And then like not only making like fake content is not true, but making content under the ruse that it was from real people, and even the people were generatively created. Which is just, it was like really spooky. It's like, you got like a whole mirage thing going on here. And so there's the opportunity to do that. Or you could leverage generative AI to help you with your research, to help you with your, like, you can help, like, there's, and I think to your point though, there are a lot of jobs right now that are really transactional on the computer, on the internet, where it's like you're copying this and summarizing it here, or you're taking this and categorizing it this way. Well, generative AI doing that now, and does it at a fairly high clip. And even if, like, going back to this whole the burger example, even if it's not doing it like at the same quality that a person's doing it, it's doing it at a high enough quality to frankly pass. And I think we're getting away, which I think is from a product experience perspective is bad, but I understand in a capitalist context, it's just the way it's going to be, is we're getting away from like a graded experience and getting into like a pass-fail experience. Like, hey, does it work or nah? Like, and then like, if you want something really rich, if you want something like a higher quality of pass, then you're going to, then that's going to be a more premium experience. It's going to be available, but it's a more premium experience. You know, I think the, when I think about living corporate, you know, to your point about like thinking like a futurist, and like, so, you know, we started back in like 2018, and we started just as a single podcast, and we were interviewing all these people, activists, elected officials, entrepreneurs, educators, all types of folks, influencers, like talking to all type of people. And like probably about a year in, I looked up and I said, dang, this is a thought leadership library, right? And it was like, so at this point, it was 2019. I was like, man, like there has to be a way I can like squeeze all the value out of this content library. But at the time, I didn't know about generative AI, right? I didn't, and also I don't, in 2019, generative AI was not in the place that it is now. So, or that it really popped off.
Very different story.
Right? It was a different thing. But I still knew that. I said, eventually, and I literally told, I used to tell my mentors this, who are a little older, and they were kind of like, I don't know what you're talking about. But I said, hey, one day there's going to be this thing where I can take this transcribed library of thought leadership, and I'm gonna be able to plug it into something, and I'm gonna then be able to operationalize all this content and make a learning platform. And they were like, nah, you're gonna need to like go work with a college for that, or hey, you need to go work with like an instructional designer for that. And I'm gonna tell you, I tried, right? Like I have some really great relationships with like some impressive universities, and they were like, hey, this is just too much content. It's too big. But I spent a lot of money trying to make it work in the ways that I was coached and like what by well-meaning people that care about me to do it, right? Then time goes on and I'm like, all right, let me see if there's like some type of tech out there. So I go into tech. Now you and I both know tech sales, a lot of tech sales be some smoke and mirrors, right? Oh, we can do that.
I've definitely been on the bad end of that equation.
Ours can do that. Are you sure? Because your website says it can. No, we can do that too.
Everything. Cool.
It can do everything. Okay.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, that sounds interesting. I don't know how y'all.
Right. Okay. Let's see. Right. So let's see it. Right. No, cannot execute. Cannot do it. So now I'm mad. Right. I'm like, okay, damn. It has to be a way to do this. I'm of the mind that like, if you can explain, if you have a desire and it's like crisp enough that you can like very easily describe it, there's probably a way to solve it. Right. And so, and time goes on, some of my old colleagues who were in tech back when we were both at PricewaterhouseCoopers, he's like, you know what, let's just build our own large language. Let's just build our own model. Let's just build it. So we built our own LLM to ingest this library into it. And so now we have this learning platform that we're selling like in a B2B context of like 1,000 learning modules, because we've modularized all of our podcasts. And so like now you have this like Spotify type experience where you can go in and make playlists and then like the content, what's dope about it is, to your point though, because like this is the thing that hung me up. I said, yo, I need somebody to go in and like categorize and then make summaries and lesson plans for all these pods. That would have cost, like, I got estimates back in. That was gonna be like for 1,000. So it's like, oh, it's gonna be like $150,000, right? It's like, it's basically, you're gonna have to hire a full time learning and development.
They're just
gonna
be doing
team.
That. And then on top of it, it's not even that, because it still costs you time. It saves you time, right? But then you are still going through and like training, making sure that person has the same eyes you do. And you still have to oversee once they even get to that place, right, where like you and them have the same eye for what you're looking for.
Right. And so like, so it was like, dang. So then, so you're absolutely right. It's the cost of time, but there's a word. The opportunity cost. The opportunity cost of like, I'm gonna spend money on that part. Just us getting at the same level. Whereas with the language model, hey, you train it, you run it through. And even if it takes a few different iterations, you know, we built out the entire learning platform and in like 3 months. Wow. Right.
But
was because we had something that we could like rapidly pump it through. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's a different, but so to your point though, I think I'm really of the mind that like folks, everyone right now, you know, you think about the world of content, right? Everything is content. Everything is content. We were talking off mic about my Afrotech tweet and like algorithm, how they push in your content. They're leveraging your content in some way to generate revenue or to generate something to lead to revenue, right? And so it's like, I'm just of the mind, it's like, yo, like if you're a content creator, you create anything that is certainly that if it's qualitative in any way, if it's a bunch of words or audio, you need to be figuring out a way to like ingest that into something that you can productize, that you can monetize in some way. Because I don't believe anybody, Ann, is out there producing content that isn't making some other entity money right now. I don't think so.
It's making somebody money out there somewhere.
It's making somebody money.
Like somehow. Even if you're talking about non-digital, you still have to buy the notebook. Like the content maybe in the notebook isn't making money, but like to write it down, right? Most of us don't know how to make paper. You still have to pay someone for that notebook.
Facts. That's a fact. So look, you know, I know you're talking about you've been a leading voice, like you've been shouting at other people, salute to you, but you've been the leading voice in like this future and intersection of AI and product development and products and the future of work. Like you have a course coming out, or it's a course coming out probably by the time this comes out, by the time we're all listening to this here, it'll probably be out. But like, talk to us about like the workshops and the conversations you're facilitating out there, and what are you hoping that people learn as they engage you?
Yeah. So upcoming, I'm actually running the second time, Jumpstart Your AI Career in conjunction with O'Reilly. It's a course I developed for them. You know, they came to me this past summer and they're like, yeah, we know you've been doing AI stuff for a while. I've developed blockchain courses with them before. And they were like, so many people are asking us about AI, and you know, we just can't put enough content out. We're behind. And I wasn't even behind, but they felt like, you know, there's more people asking about it now than we have the content to properly serve them. And I think really where I find my niche is really being able to explain AI, and also like, you know, how do you think about your roadmap for learning about AI, whether it's like to get a new job or just to really understand it in ways that, you know, almost anybody can understand. You know, there's a lot of fancy words out there, you know, that's fine. Those are real things in the industry. Like we use those words, but for like the average person who's just getting started, I want this to feel more accessible to them, because the reality is, you like to think as humans we're all on the same team, not always, but like I think right now we want, now more than ever, especially in the next few years, really on the same team. And I want to make sure that this is really accessible to people, because there's some brilliant minds out there talking about it, and when they talk about it, sometimes it just goes over people's heads, because they're talking about it like way up here and they're like, I need you to bring it down. And you know, also just doing certain podcasts like this, where it's like for people to kind of be like, oh, okay, here's maybe where I get started, or this is maybe why it's important to me, or, oh, I hadn't thought about, you know, how I should be learning about, you know, working with AI. And I think that's my thing this year, is like, how do I help people understand this in an accessible way? But also, like I said, my theme this year is telling people, like, how do you think like a futurist? Right now it's AI, but what are the technologies on the fringes that could pick up? And I can't remember if there's a second part to your question.
No, you answered it, right? I really wanted to know, like, just what is it that you want people to get away from these courses from engaging you, right? And so I've heard that theme throughout our conversation, like this idea of being a future. I think, and I will say, so it's like two forces coming together, right? It's the acceleration of technology while also being like in this late stage capitalist society where we're always continuing, like the cycles of, like all the cycles are shorter. Everything is shorter. Everything is faster, right? The expectation for it to, okay, we got to make this, okay, how do we make the next $1 billion, right? And so, And with people being the cogs in that capitalist machine, then there's like this question for the people of like, okay, well, what do I need to do next so that I can be ahead, so I can actually still stay employed? I also think there's just a lot of like, I empathize with like the very real pressure. You said something earlier about like people who may have been like in one career for the past 20 years, all of a sudden laid off trying to like start over again. And so you're 45, you're 55, and you don't have a super sexy LinkedIn. You don't have a really great headshot. You don't have like, you don't have a big online presence. You were just an accountant at, you know, Southwest or wherever. And now you're trying to find another job again. And you want to maybe work for another 10 years, maybe, before you retire. And so, like, you know, you think about the fact people living out their cars, working two jobs. I mean, it's just a lot. So, like, salute to you for demystifying the space, and then also encouraging folks to like understand, like, okay, this is what you need to be doing. And I think looking forward, like thinking in a futurist way. And I also think like we're in this age where, again, I firmly believe it. If you can cleanly articulate it, then there's likely a way to make it happen. And so, you know, so thinking that way and being brave enough, even just to yourself, to like say, okay, you know what? I really want to do this next, or I really want to get in this space next. Like, that's hard. Like, that could be really scary. And so I just think it's dope work what you're doing. Look, and friend of the show, welcome back anytime. Where can people find you? We'll put the links in the show notes, but plug your stuff. Come on.
Yeah. You can find me on my website at annetgriffin.com. So AnnetGriffin. You can also find me on Twitter, though I'm tweeting a lot less these days. AnnetGriffin on Twitter. I would say, and then feel free to, you know, find me on LinkedIn. My LinkedIn name is also AnnetGriffin, but I would just recommend, if you try to add me, write a little note, say you listen to this podcast. And also, anytime you add someone on LinkedIn, unless they are like someone you talk to every day, you should always leave a note about why you were adding them. You know, so would love to hear from you. And, you know, message me if you're also interested in learning more about Jumpstart Your AI Career. Also working with O'Reilly on an audio only version of that. And so that'll be coming out. So there'll be the live class and then an audio only version as well.
Love it. I love it. And, we can't wait to see and continue to support, amplify the work you're doing. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
And we're back. Yo, thank you so much for rocking with us at Living Corporate. So excited. Make sure that you check out the links in the show notes to learn more about Living Corporate. If ain't nobody else tell you today, I'm going to tell you right now, I love you. You matter. Take care of yourself. Later.
Living Corporate is a podcast by Living Corporate LLC. Our logo was designed by David Dawkins. Our theme music was produced by Ken Brown. Additional music production by Antoine Franklin for Musical Elevation. Post-production is handled by Jeremy Jackson. Got a topic suggestion? Email us at livingcorporatepodcast@gmail.com. You can find us online on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and living-corporate.com. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.